The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, things happen when people start talking. You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU School of Business. Programs are also made possible in part by a grant from the Idaho Humanities Council, the state-based affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. Forum series sponsors are AARP Idaho, Bank of Idaho, Echelon Group, Micron, and St. Luke's Health System. The moderator for today's forum is Greg Hahn.
All right, hello and welcome to today's City Club of Boise Forum, exploring the potential future of transportation in the Boise Valley. I'm Greg Hahn. I'm a board member at the City Club and today's moderator. I want to welcome our radio listeners today. They're joining us via Boise State Public Radio on KBS K91.5 and its affiliates throughout southern Idaho and northern Nevada. I think that's KBSX. I think I screwed that up in my writing. Boise State Public Radio is one of our media partners, along with 670 KBUI, the Idaho Statesman, Idaho Public Television, and Peppershock Media. I want to thank them all, as well as our university partners, Northwest Nazarene University, Boise State University, and the University of Idaho, Boise. Today's forum is kind of a special one. It culminates a summer of discussions that events and speakers have represented a deep dive into some of the issues facing our valley as we grow quickly and as technology changes around us. For the first time, we think ever, maybe, a group of the area's leading organizations involved in transportation worked together to explore some thoughtful transportation planning and the issues around it. In April, the Southwest Idaho chapter of WTS, which is an organization that encourages equity and empowers women in transportation, they held a panel discussion called Emerging Trends and Technology in the Transportation Field. In May, the Urban Land Institute of Idaho put on an event called Turning Transportation Vision into Reality, How Public and Private Sectors Can Align Land Use and Transportation. Ada County Highway District's Commuter Ride brought in a national speaker in May, or to honor May in Motion. It was actually in June, the award winners with a June talk called The Future of Mobility. And in August, Compass, which is the Community Planning Association of Southwest Idaho, they spearheaded a conversation by another national planning leader, and it was called Try It Before You Buy It, New Ways to Build Cities. So the four events, they featured speakers and panelists from all over the country and top experts from the Treasure Valley. And I want to point out the whole thing was kind of pulled together by Commuter Ride's Maureen Gresham, who's here and who said it wasn't that hard. But you can imagine if you've ever tried to pull five organizations together into one place, it was not an easy task. So let's give her a quick round of applause for making this happen. So the conversations, this is partially how it worked. They could find a point where they could connect on one idea. So they focused in large part around a planning concept called transportation demand management. That's what folks in the field call TDM. So if you hear that coming up, that's what that means. The idea is that a community can and should look beyond just expanding capacity to meet the projected needs of new cars on the roads, right? How you think of it's transportation planning. Instead, look at your existing infrastructure. How do you maximize the use of the network that exists today? Maybe by encouraging alternate modes of transportation like cycling or public transit. Maybe by alternate routing, maybe even by applying strategies that reduce demand on the roads at certain times or redistribute the demand into different spaces. I just came to the very end of what I know about TDM. So that was it. That was your lesson for the day. But I have good news. It's not going to be me talking about this. These folks, they spent all summer diving into these subjects so the rest of us could benefit from the insight. That was kind of the neat idea behind the series, that each of the four groups would choose someone who would then commit to spend their summer learning about transportation at all of these events, and then we would have this event here at the City Club where they could tell us what it is they learned. So these four gathered here to share that, what they've learned, what they're optimistic about, what kept them up at night since they've learned it. I think there might be a few of those. And how maybe we could pull it all together to shape the valley into the best place it can be. Before I introduce them, though, I want to remind everybody we have question cards at every table. I do have one already. So somebody gets a gold star. I always come prepared with some questions, but of course the City Club The depth of a City Club conversation comes from you. And since we have so many Boise High students, I would love it if the students ask a question, go ahead and write student at the bottom, and we'll know that it's really important because you guys are the ones inheriting this place, and we should be paying attention to what you think. So let's welcome in the order that, I don't know what order they're sitting in, but in the order I happen to write these down. So we'll start in the middle. Diane Bevins. She's the manager of capital projects at the Ada County Highway District. She was the choice of WTS, what used to be called Women in Transportation Seminars. She represented them. She's been with ACHD since 2009. Now she oversees the project managers, the right-of-way team, the utilities team, and like a $40 million budget. So thank you, Diane. We have Karen Sander. She's closest to me here. She's the Idaho Marketing Manager for HDR Engineering. She was the Urban Land Institute representative and a City Club board member, so she, of all of them, knew what she was getting into. Before joining that firm, she spent more than a decade directing Downtown Boise Association, so you might know her from there. Angie Gribble, there in the red and black, System Wellness Manager at St. Luke's Health System. So Commuter Ride, of course, strives to serve Boise's employers' needs, and they wanted to choose somebody who represents those the employers and the employees that work there. Angie works on well-being strategies to improve the health of companies, employees, general community members. Make sure you ask her all the very technical questions about transportation policy, because she will love that. Okay, and since Compass is made up of local government agencies, it made sense that the group's pick was Nicole Baird Spencer, who's down there on the end. She's a planner with the City of Eagle. She's been there for about 16 years. She does project management, transportation, comprehensive planning, demographics, large project entitlement, all the things that probably an underfunded city asks somebody to do when they have the need. So I'm going to get rolling into the questions, but I have a few to start. And I promised these four I would not make them give opening remarks. I mean, the beauty of this, the beauty of today's conversation is that it's not a panel of speakers and experts who are used to getting up here and telling everybody what they think, but it's some folks who volunteered to kind of dive into some issues and really explore what could happen if we started looking at the technology and the futures that we have. So I'm going to start with a few questions. I've already got one, but please get these rolling in, because the sooner your questions roll in, the better the conversation will be. So number one, and I'll just start here with Karen because she's closest to me, and we'll just run down the row. What's the biggest thing? What one thing stuck with you after you walked through these events?
I had four, but he's going to make me do one. I came away with this, that we need to embrace Compass's regional transportation plan and align county and city land use plans and have the leadership to do that.
That's Angie?
The biggest thing I took away is we have a lot of innovation coming out in this industry of transportation with technology coming and industry disruptors. So it's really going to take a collaborative conversation from many sectors to come together and determine what's the future they want to see in this valley and then what's the transportation plan that meets that desired future.
All right, Diane.
Well, Cara Miller said this at one of the events, that the only option that's not valid and looking ahead is business as usual. And I think a lot of people say that, but and it seems simple, but getting people to do something innovative and do something different and change is not always easy. And we have legacy employees, we have legacy policies, and you know it's like steering a ship. So we have to change, we have to do things different. It's as some of the other ladies have already said, you know, who's going to take the lead on that and who's going to do that?
All right, Nicole.
So I think the one biggest takeaway I took away is technology is changing, and we don't know where it's going. I think the highest standard we could say is, you know, 50s, we were going to all be in flying cars, right? But we were all going to be behind the wheel of those flying cars. Well, guess what? Cars aren't flying, and we're learning people aren't behind those wheels anymore either. So I think that adaptability, that understanding that change is coming and that we need to be adaptable. For the kids from school out here, you know, 65%, according to Brookings Institute study, 65% of kids in grade school today will be working in jobs that haven't yet been invented. And so I think our ability to be adaptable, see our system change, and equitably use the system we have to adapt to that change that we don't know quite yet what's coming.
Well, I had a series of questions that I kind of thought could set the tone here. And my other one, and maybe we'll just start down there with Nicole, because hers is a little different. She's a local government representative. But because you represent business and nonprofits and planners and cities and agencies, I'm just kind of curious, what do you think, since you've gone through this process, what should other folks in our community who share your perspective? What should the cities be thinking about? In your case, Nicole, what does the cities, and I'll just do this individually, what do the cities need to be thinking about when they're looking ahead at these needs and opportunities?
I think one of the biggest challenges and what we need to be looking at as local government is to see beyond the current circumstance. I think in land use planning specifically, we spend a lot of time with an application or a specific issue in front of us, and that's how we address the world, is does it meet our standards, does it meet our code, does statute apply? And we have these checklists we use, but we don't spend a lot of time looking forward and saying, beyond the problem we're dealing with now, what's the problem that's coming? And I think that design thinking, that understanding of there's a bigger community, regardless once I retire from the city of Eagle, there will be somebody else that has to take that mantle. And was the city prepared and positioned for that? And I really think the biggest challenge to local governments is to go out and say, who are we? Not today, but who are we in 2050, 2070? And what does that look like? And I think that's the biggest change and challenge that I could say we need to look at.
Diane, from the highway district's perspective, I mean, I guess you're the only highway district in the county, but you got to work with folks outside. I mean, we're connecting to Canyon County. We connect to folks driving in from Mountain Home. I mean, how do you look at it from your perspective, and how should they be thinking about it?
Well, I think it's similar to what Nicole said, that we can get so wrapped up in the immediate project and the immediate issue that's in front of us, that it's hard to look ahead. Can I answer this from WTS perspective?
Please, of
as
course.
Because I would say ACHD is a similar situation as the city. But from WTS, an organization that is all about getting access and equity for women in transportation, I'm assuming not everyone in this room is a transportation professional, but nationwide, there's only 15% women in the transportation industry. And there's something wrong with that when 50% of our customers are women. So we all are affected by transportation, and maybe your business has an impact or can participate in business. So I would encourage everyone in this room to go back to your companies, to go back to your agencies, to go back to your organizations, and look at how many women you have in your organization. And statistically, at the college level and entry-level positions, women are fairly equally represented, but it's when they start moving through their careers. So you look at supervisors, managers, the executive level, board members, that's when the disparity happens. And if we're going to face these challenges, these unknown challenges even, as we move forward, it just seems like a disservice to our users to not have them fully represented. The 50% of women that are users of transportation did not have 50% women looking at the solution. So I would say that transportation is a people business, and the more that it is about people, then the more women will be there to lead.
All right, thank you. And I should point out, I think Maureen just said, realize that every single person who planned and is now executing this event was a woman, except for me, who didn't really do much except stand here. So that's a tiny baby step towards the right direction. Angie, maybe thinking less from a little bit from an employer, I think probably maybe ask you from a couple perspectives, from thinking about the health of your employees at Luke's, but also then thinking about the kind of population health and community health. I mean, how does that play a role in how we look ahead?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm kind of playing the employer hat first. Employers have an opportunity to really recognize the impact that they make broader than maybe just the service they provide. There's really four pillars of health that an employer can have an impact on. One being consumer health, so those customers that you serve, and are you promoting health with the products you give them and the way they access your services. Employee health, so those that work for you, and how might you make decisions around your work schedules or your staffing, the infrastructure around your campus, to support health and maybe active transportation or alternative transportation modes for your employees. Then there's the community health, so that community in which you are located, what's the impact that you make to the broader community that you serve? And then that fourth pillar is environmental health, so how does the footprint of your business impact the environment? And so transportation can play in all four of those pillars that a business can have an impact on. So I encourage businesses to recognize the decisions that you make in each of those areas and what are those outcomes or consequences consequences potentially around health for all those areas, and how might transportation or transportation conversations play into that. From a health perspective, or the healthcare agency, St. Luke's every 3 years conducts a community health needs assessment, and we'll actually be publishing our most recent version in the next month. And those health assessments help us recognize what are those health needs that are bubbling up to the top in our communities. And that are coming out this next month, three of the needs can be directly impacted by transportation. One is obesity and diabetes. Another is mental health, and a third one is access to care. So those are needs that are bubbling up to the top in our Treasure Valley community that we as healthcare organizations recognize we need to start playing in and start making a difference, which, again, transportation planning, transportation conversations can have an impact in all three of those areas by increasing physical activity, promoting good mental health, and increasing that access to care. So as a healthcare organization, we might be a non-traditional partner in some of these conversations, but we're starting to realize that we do play a role in this transportation because we need to make a difference in those areas for the health of our patients and the health of our community.
Yeah, thanks, Karin. I mean, employers as well, but also kind of a business player in the community, right? I mean, transportation affects all of us, whether we're Boise State or we're a two-person shop in downtown
absolutely.
Boise.
One of the speakers, Cooper Martin with the National League of Cities, I think he said this really well, and just some background on this. They've done a lot of research on existing transportation plans, and he noted at this presentation that many transportation plans which project outcomes decades into the future focus almost exclusively on the problem of automobile congestion and prescribed increased infrastructure in the form of new roads as the primary cure. And what you're hearing today is that technology, our aging population, younger generations, technologies that are impacting delivery. If you think about how many deliveries are now done with regard to, you know, Amazon, Uber, Lyft, all of this, you know, there's very little of these plans that are addressing these issues. Of the report that they did, 6% of the plans consider potential effects of driverless technology. So when you consider, though, that you know, of the markets that they looked at, 60 of the 68 markets that they looked at have Uber or Lyft or these deliveries. So we're not looking at our actual transportation plans. We're not looking to the future and the impacts of what these technologies, aging, we're looking at road diets and health. You know, do we have sidewalks? Do we have connectivity? Are we, you know, the bigger picture? So I would say, you know, things that we need to be looking at is we need to look at our existing transportation plans and embracing these trends that are coming at us, and also looking at compact development. One of the speakers, Reed Ewing, talked about embracing the 5 Ds of compact development: density, diversity, design, distance to transit, and destination accessibility. When we're looking at income equality and health again, and how we access transit, all of these things should be playing into these plans. And every one of these speakers during these presentations touched on it in some way, shape, or form. And I think we need to look at what our transportation plans currently say, and are we embracing these new technologies and trends?
Right. Well, and they change so fast. I mean, it's this is a student question, so you just somebody's paying attention out there at Boise High, and I really appreciate it. In the last several years, we've seen a rise in private transportation solutions such as Uber, Bird scooters. Going forward, and maybe we'll jump down to the city planner and the NACHD with those hats on a little bit. Going forward, what do you believe the role is of these private transportation options in an outdated system? And I think we'd all probably agree that that happens faster than we think it does. Should it complement existing systems? Should it compete? Nicole.
Oh, yay. let's see. So I think these alternative and emerging transportation options, they're filling a gap. And I think that's what we first have to understand, is this is a market system. They wouldn't exist if they weren't needed. And so we're recognizing that these Lyft, Ubers, scooters are all meant to give somebody a short commute or an option that they can't do. And I think often we overlook in the transportation planning and sometimes in city planning the people who don't drive, right? We have a very young population, people under the age of 15 in the state of Idaho, people who are maybe older and aging out and aren't able to be independently mobile, and the ability for them to get around. A fixed route bus system is a great option. If you have a fixed route bus system, we don't have one in Eagle. There's no bus in Eagle today. So for those seniors and those young people, these really do fill a gap. I think they're going to continue to emerge, and we're going to see them continue to adapt as we build the environment that determines whether they're needed anymore. I think as long as we continue to look at suburban exterior development, when we look at residentially dominated communities, we will continue to see a need for transportation enhancement to come in some way, whether that be a single vehicle or these emergent technologies to fill those gaps that single vehicles can't handle.
Thanks. Diane, do you?
Well, at ACHD, there's no specific model or way to consider Uber and Lyft. I mean, they're a vehicle mile travel, they're a trip, and that is accounted for. And it is showing that these technologies are not reducing vehicle miles traveled as we would hope they would, or that transit would. So we're seeing that stay consistent. So, you know, when we build out a road from 2 lanes to 5 lanes, I mean, that's helping create the space for Uber and Lyft and delivery drivers. And we also, for our models, may be around traffic. I just want to point this out. So we know we need a 5-lane road, let's say, but we have a complete streets policy, and we have many, many plans that consider peds and bikes and other modes. So every road we build includes bike facilities and pedestrian facilities, and we coordinate with VRT for bus stops and transit facilities as well. So, you know, our focus is building out our network that does allow all users and all modes to use them.
Okay. You know, so a few people had questions about the scooter thing, and since we're on the subject, and maybe Nicole, I'll just bounce back to you really quickly. Because this is kind of an enforcement question. Do we need to worry about greenbelt scoot, you know, electric scooters on the greenbelt and unsafe riding, and how are the, and maybe this is a different part of the city than you deal with, but it must be a conversation that comes up. How do we start engaging as these new, especially that personal mode of transportation stuff? Anyone who's driven in Boise has seen somebody fly by on a scooter, and some of us have flown by on a scooter, and I know it from both sides.
Now I know who was whizzing me last weekend. You know, I think one of the biggest challenges with the scooters is not necessarily that they exist or that they pollute the greenbelt. I really think it goes back to social responsibility. Everybody needs to have the same social responsibility when using these gap systems. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to see anybody on the greenbelt whizzing past me on a scooter. I don't want anybody whizzing past me on a bicycle if I've got 3 kids towing behind me. And I think that's part of any society. That's the social contract we all agree to when we live in a city. If you didn't want to deal with people, you go somewhere out where you don't have to. I think it is a parameter that the city, all cities deal with. Eagle doesn't have scooters. We've geofenced our city as they've come out, with the understanding that we need to have policy and we need to understand how they interact with our community. Where do we want them? Where don't we want them? Eagle's a city of 4 highways. We don't want them on the highway. It's not a safe interaction on the highway. Now, could they be on the greenbelt? Maybe. Would they be appropriate in downtown? Probably. But I think those are the decisions that have to be made uniquely to each place. But I do think it goes back to the citizenry and those people who are involved and engaged in that community, that they have that conversation about what that means in their community.
Right. Angie, are there health? Has this bubbled up into your world? I know most of the people I know who ride the scooters regularly have fallen off the scooter at least once. I'm not going to say what happened to me, but let's just... I can feel it a little bit in my wrist sometimes.
I would say certainly from a health perspective, just the safety aspect of it. So I think, as you mentioned earlier, some of these technologies just popped up really rapidly and really fast, and it might have felt like all of a sudden there's scooters on the corner. What are these? Where do they go? What do we do about that? So I feel like, as Nicole mentioned, as long as, you know, cities are being really thoughtful about the advent of these types of technologies into their community, and doing their best due diligence in educating community members on how to use those, and relying on social responsibility, I think that's the best way. But certainly we want people to be safe as much as possible.
I just have a comment. Most of the presentations that were done, every time that micromobility, which is where your scooters and your e-bikes fall, everybody did not see it coming. They did not see the boom in microtransit coming. So when you think about just how quickly that took off, I think it took most planners by surprise. And so I think everybody's reacting to it versus being proactive in many instances. So I think, you know, when what you had asked the question about, you know, what are those things that came as a surprise, even to me, as, you know, one day you're driving along and the next day you're looking, there's scooters everywhere. So I think it took everybody by surprise.
Right. Yeah, let me ask about technology a little bit, and we haven't had a lot of flowing in on that, but I know that that was a discussion all summer long, that technology doesn't change just how I might get around the town, but it probably affects how we even know who's going where and who's going what and how you do the planning. I mean, can you all talk, and I don't know who wants to jump in first, about what kind of changes in technology do you think are kind of on the forefront here? What's about to happen that's going to maybe change the way we look at some of this transportation planning?
I think just some of the things that we need to look at when you look at an urban environment is your space at a sidewalk where people are being picked up. You know, is it safe for these cars just to pull up and people are running into the street to get access into an Uber or Lyft? So I think, you know, re-looking at the space available, the delivery space, you know, when you've got so many more vehicles delivering, how are you accommodating those deliveries? So I think thinking outside, not just about the modes, but how do you accommodate those modes? So I think, you know, even from a planning perspective, an engineering perspective, I think our streets are going to look very different when you try and accommodate how technology is impacting, you know, whether it's driverless vehicles, the autonomous vehicles.
And are there really going to be drone deliveries? Is that going to happen?
They're doing pilot projects now.
I know, so it's terrifying to me.
You can see little robots running around. So, how cool.
So one thing that's maybe not way out in the distant future, but we could see it soon in the Treasure Valley, is the traffic signals being able to talk to your car or your phone. So there's a Bluetooth connectivity, so it's this connected vehicle idea. And the idea is it makes it safer. So your Bluetooth in your car or your phone, the traffic signal can pick that up. But if it knows you're going a certain speed and the light turns yellow and they know there's no way you can stop, the signal can adapt and give you a little bit more yellow time. So there's a lot of exciting things that could make our roads safer and
go faster.
Is that was that a titter of excitement or a titter of terror? I used to, years and years ago, I dated a woman who worked at Flying Pie, and she delivered pizza, and she knew exactly when the lights changed, and she could get through town in, like, no time at all. And a friend said, this is great until a delivery person from the other Flying Pie is going this direction, and then you guys are in trouble.
Well, how about a very loaded 18-wheeler that their stopping distance is a lot longer than an average passenger vehicle, and that signal's reading that truck is coming too fast or doesn't have enough room to stop. So I'll put it in that perspective so people don't get the idea that now they can just
do whatever we want. Man.
Run
it's like
yellow
and
red lights all the time.
Nicole,
Well, I think that's a fair statement, and I think what's already been stated is, you know, as communities, we have to look at how the transportation environment is part of the built environment. And I think that's something as communities we have to be ready for. And we often deal with landowners, and some of my statements may be only mine and not that of the City of Eagles, but we often deal with developers that they have a plan for what they want to do, and it's very thought through for that concept, but it's not generational. And I think one of the things we are going to see, and one of the things that probably hit me the most in this discussion, was at the WTS meeting was the discussion of parking garages. We spend a lot, I mean, look around downtown, even where we are today. What's on the main floor, bottom floor of this building is a large parking garage. What's going to happen when technology is different? When we have autonomous vehicles who can park themselves and don't have to let a passenger out to park and be stored, and they can move without needing to have somebody there to do it. We have a lot of space in our communities open for redevelopment, open for different uses. And I think the idea and concept of making sure that we're designing our communities to be able to be adaptable in the future, that we haven't pigeoned our hold ourselves into the teardown model, which I think we had done for a long time in the 60s and early 70s, which was, we'll build it, and if we don't like it in 20 years, we'll just tear it down. Really investing more meaningful into our communities, structures that can be adaptively reused, have a meaningful place in the society.
Okay. Well, you know, you brought something up about the semi-trucks, and we do have a question a little bit that says, as we move forward to, you know, scooters and obviously cyclists, we've got a lot of folks kind of asking about roads like Cartwright, you know, that are, and I, you know, all, as well as riding a scooter a lot, I have a road bike, and I know that feeling. I've driven, ride down Cartwright, or I ride down Hill Road, and I drive down Cartwright, and I drive on Hill Road. But how do you envision a future that is going to always have big trucks, right? There's going to be large things that need to be moved around. There's going to be more and more modes of transportation. How does that prospect change? Is it similar to how we used to plan in the past, or are we at a point where we can really start maybe using technology and using our understanding of how a better way of maybe mapping traffic through a city or through a valley that can kind of have all of these groups as maybe primary beneficiaries of the planning? Does that make any sense? I mean, are there different ways of looking at it? Can we say cars are the most important? I mean, I think it feels to folks, you know, some people probably say, oh, the trucks are the only thing they think about on the highways. Or some truckers will say, oh, the cars are the only thing they think about on the highways. And the cyclists say, oh, the cars are the only thing they think about. And the cars are like, I'm sick of these cyclists. It's all everybody ever thinks about. Are we at a point where we can kind of start to bridge some of those differences?
I would say it's being done already. There's a lot of work that's being done with complete streets. I think it's already been mentioned. ACHD has a policy on that. There's a lot of work to be done on it, but I think there's a place and time for different modes. And I think it's been mentioned, you don't want scooters on a five-lane highway. I think it really comes down to planning and planning where it's relevant and where there is the real estate to be able to accommodate some of these. So I really think there needs to be an eye on, this is the non-planner talking here, but I think there really needs to be an eye on what the needs of that community are and incorporate them into, if we're going to have more cyclists on the road, that there's a more comprehensive look at making sure that there are safe streets as well. So I'll pass it on to the experts.
I mean, we do have a complete streets policy, but one of the speakers, and I can't remember which one it was, said maybe you shouldn't try to make every road fit every mode all the time. Maybe you have parallel routes. So that could be something that we could look at. And at ACHD, we're starting to, you know, the traditional five-lane road with a stripe and a five-foot bike lane, that was great 10, 15, 20 years ago. But we're starting to figure out people don't really feel safe and they don't really use that as a bike facility. Mm-hmm. So now we have better options. And a lot of that is taking that even out of the between the curbs, right? Getting that as a 10-foot pathway on either side of the road. So then it's that whole 8 to 80. You know, all users can feel safe using those facilities. So, you know, a lot of things curb to curb are pretty set. We have billions of dollars of infrastructure just in Ada County alone. So if you think about that nationwide, we're not going to be able to just rebuild all that curb to curb. We have to reallocate the space, look at better uses for the space, take things outside that curb, and which is mostly, you know, ped and bikes. So I think that's the thing to keep in mind. We don't have enough funding to do the things we want to do and to do the things that are coming, so we definitely can't go back and rebuild everything curb to curb to allow some, you know, different things. I think we have to get creative. So
I'm just going to add, just as a city planner, you know, we have street hierarchies and functionalities of road that we're trying to design roads to do. We've had great experience just as late working with ACHD on a ped bike plan for the city of Eagle, where we talk about what is the pedestrian element on this road, and is it appropriate to the land uses that are adjacent to it, similar to bikes. So you may have a low stress network, which is just you on your cruiser in the lane of traffic, and that's okay. If it's a local road and it has low volumes on it, that's okay. It's not stressful to be on that road. But when you do get to a Linder Road or something like that, where you're talking 5 to 7 lanes, you want to be off. You want a dedicated space. And I think that's the sensitivity that as planners, both at the city and at the highway district and ITD, we have to build those relationships and build those conversations, establishing those expectations. But also those users have to understand that. A state highway is not always going to be, though maybe the most direct, the most user-friendly road for a pedestrian or a bicyclist. And we can try to make them adaptable as much as we can, but they may not be intended for that. If people don't use highways, one of my biggest things is you don't get on a highway for a mile run. That's not the point of the highway. That's not what the hierarchy works for. A highway is meant to have longer runs, crossed communities. They're not supposed to be, I need to go pick up Johnny from baseball practice, at one exit down the highway. That's what the local roads are for. So if we kind of also, not just as planners plan differently, but we also have to be as users, understand that as well. Because our expectations have to be guided by what our investment is.
Well, before we're about halfway through, a little bit more than that, before we get to the next question, I want to remind the radio listeners what you're listening to. It's a City Club of Boise Forum on the future of transportation in the Valley. My name is Greg Hahn, and with me on stage are Diane Bevins. She's the manager of capital projects at the Ada County Highway District. Karin Sander, the Idaho marketing manager for HDR Engineering. Angie Gribble, system wellness manager at St. Luke's Health System. And Nicole Baird Spencer, a planner with City of Eagle. Now, another reminder to the radio audience, this is a culmination of a summer of events, and they were hosted by the Southwest Idaho chapter of WTS, the Urban Land Institute of Idaho, ACHD's Commuter Ride, and Compass, the Community Planning Association of Southwest Idaho. Let's shift a little bit. You guys are doing a great job asking questions, and I'm never going to be able to get to all of them, and I apologize for that, but I'm going to kind of pull some together. People are... one of the things we haven't talked about yet is light rail. Did the summer kind of include ways? I guess this is kind of a twofold question. How do we start connecting the two sides of the valley? And is light rail something that feels like its time has come?
I'll start with that. I think there was a lot of discussion about when you start to plan this, you have to preserve your corridors. Because if the corridors are not there, to go back after time and try and get those back is going to be impossible. So not only preserving corridors, but one of the presenters really talked about preserving where you're going to have your transit stations, whether that's for rail or bus or whatever it is. But you have to preserve that land so that when you're planning out, that it's there. So it comes back to planning. But if you don't have that land available, it's going to be really, really expensive and really hard and onerous to be able to go back and do that after the fact. So I think that was discussed quite a bit.
Okay, I'll jump in. there's a systemic and statutorial issue in the state of Idaho on transit. There is no dedicated funding source for transit. Transit is paid for out of local governments at their annual budgeting process, and then through federal funding. That's how we pay for transit. And if we really want to, as a valley, see something innovative, we want to see light rail. And I know at this point in our lives, we don't think light rail, innovation. For this valley, it would be. And until we really start planning that way and we start looking for a place to fund permanent, consistent, annual funding that's not based upon the appropriations of another body, we are not going to see this type of transit in this valley. So statutorily, I think we all, as citizens, need to say, if this is an investment we want, we start communicating with our legislators, we start advocating for it at the local level, because that's the only way it's going to change.
What about bus rapid transit? That comes up now and then, and somebody asked about that specifically. Is that a piece of the puzzle, at least on the near term, if we can't get that legislature to grant that taxing authority?
Bus rapid transit has actually been a discussion. It's on the State Street Transit and Traffic Operations Plan, which is actually a cooperative with ITD, ACHD, the City of Eagle, City of Garden City, and the City of Boise, which is really talking about how does State Street change over time. We're getting to a place that there are some major improvements going in through ACHD on the corridor, and long term, we're going to max that corridor out. And what's it going to look like? And bus rapid transit is part of that plan. Again, still no funding source for transit. So again, we're still focused on local governments having to make decisions annually about how they allocate funds to make that function on the corridors of importance. But it is an interim step.
Yeah. I would tag on to that. One of the things that exists in the state of Idaho is that our current high occupancy vehicle lanes are only a provision for population less than 25,000. So when you think about changing our mind and being able to have some of these technologies, what they call HOV lanes are not allowed on our freeways or a place like State Street. That needs to change really quickly at the legislative level so that we can start to accommodate some of these not-so-new technologies, bus rapid transit, commuter rides, HOV lanes, you name it. HOV lanes is more than one person in a single occupancy vehicle. So I really think there are some, in my mind, a low-hanging fruit that we can start to make some adjustments and think about things that wouldn't take a large amount of funding to accomplish. So to answer the question in a different way, should we be looking at bus rapid transit? We should be looking at all modes of transit and looking at something that people can use in a way that makes the most sense for them.
Yeah. And you've got the St. Luke's Health Systems has urban spaces, you know, downtown Boise and over in, you know, kind of in the suburban areas and in some of the rural areas. I mean, how, as you're interacting with kind of the employees, what are they sort of looking for in terms of that getting to and from work? Because they don't all live off Warm Springs and ride their bikes over to Luke's, I can't imagine.
Yes, yeah. We do have a lot of employees coming to our campuses day in and day out. And so something certainly we have that we consider. We have a department that's, or a staff in a department that's focused on employee well-being that includes employee transportation. So we do some incentives and some programming to try to encourage people to use some of those alternative modes, commuter ride, vanpool, bike, walk, those types of things. So that's something that we do to try to encourage it. But certainly from an infrastructure, we've consolidated some of our buildings that we had in downtown Boise, so we'll have one campus for most of our non-patient facing functions, and that eliminates inner office or inter-day travel for meetings and whatnot, so hopefully people come to their office and stay there for the whole day instead of traveling in and out. And also some of our rural communities, the concern there I think is more patients, you know, making sure patients have access to our facilities and patients are getting to the care that they need either at that facility or the next nearest facility. So some of the things that we've done is looking at partnerships with Valley Regional Transit on a rides to wellness and other busing or transportation options for our patients to make sure they have access to the care when they're in their more rural communities.
All right. So the students are not surprisingly concerned about the future. A few of them have said, you know, how far behind are we in transportation planning? They have a number. I don't know if I want to share it with everybody because it's just sort of depressing. Is it that 20 years? Does that seem up or down? I think we're probably doing better than that. Because transportation planning, of course, changes every second. And I think that's one of the subtexts of this, of the conversation, is that adaptability, right? How do you adapt to scooters that were a crazy idea one day and then all over the streets the next day, right? How do you adapt to the decision by, is it 48 Californians a day to decide to move into the Treasure Valley? I mean, how, and maybe I'll jump over to you, Diane, how we talk about, you think about transportation planning as this very long-term thing. We got to figure out where we're going to be in 50 years, but we have no idea what technology is going to do in that time period. How do you embrace adaptability, or how do you have to do that?
That's a good question. At ACHD, I don't think we're addressing it specifically. Okay. A lot of it's unknown. A lot of it is land use related. So, you know, we have to partner with our cities. We do have a 20-year plan. We have a 5-year plan. A lot of our county is not rural anymore, and we still have a lot of two-lane rural roads. There are section line arterial roadways. So, you know, I don't have a good answer to that question. It's just that we have to build out our network, and we're behind on that part already. If you think about the two-lane roads we still have around, they were built, you know, long enough ago, they don't even have sidewalks, and they're fully developed. And so it's hard to think about an unknown technology 20 years from now when we still need to fill in sidewalk gaps and have safe routes to schools and get our two-lane country roads to a five-lane urban arterial with all modes. So.
Right. Yeah, Carl.
I would say where we are behind, and I think it's been mentioned already, is funding. And we don't have a dedicated source. So how can you even think about in incorporating all these changes that are coming at us if we don't have a funding source?
I think statutorily we've also siloed ourselves. And I've said it before, and it's just my thought, but only in Idaho, if we don't like something, government, do we create more of it. So we've created a fracturing of the governmental entities who have to interact. Mm-hmm. Not that I don't have a great relationship with ACHD, I do, but I've worked in four other states, and I've never, as a local government, not had control over local roads to have a conversation about design and what that means. Instead, I have to work with ACHD. We see that with special purpose districts as well, sewer districts, water districts. And I think that's indicative of one of the challenges that as we move forward over the next 20 years, we've got to get away from, is this understanding that I will only do what I am statutorily mandated to do because that's my limitation. We've got to give entities the ability to meaningfully interact, not just plan together, but develop together to make sure we're not just passing the buck. And I think that's what I hear most probably in our jurisdiction and across the valley is, I don't know how many people have told me, I'm tired of hearing that it's not the city's fault that the highway is doing X, Y, or Z. I don't like to hear that the city can't control schools. But that's what we've done. We've created government that is isolated and single purpose. And when we focus on that, we lose that capacity to have that balancing act together.
Well, stay down there with you two for a second. You keep putting the planners and on the spot, and the project managers and the supervisors. But the students are kind of interested in, and not just the students. We have some other folks who've asked about global warming. I mean, how do we factor in this valley? How do we factor pollution and the environment and global warming into planning, or should we be doing it a different way? Just go ahead and tell your bosses on the radio what to do differently, please. I realize what I just asked you. Some of them might be in the room, so you don't even have to wait until it airs.
So congestion management is a form of dealing with pollution and thinking about global warming. So if a car is sitting in traffic and idling, then that's creating pollution. So it is a factor in our planning and what we do. And we do some federal aid projects, which has a lot more stringent environmental process that we follow for that as well.
I think you can also look at this, and there are things we do. We have an air quality board. Maybe had something to do with not being, you know, so good in the past, but we do work through emissions testing programs. The City of Eagle has recently, just in their most recent budget, established an environmental and sustainability fund, which I think is amazing that even a small government is looking at that. And again, I know this is like my mother coming out in me again, but look at yourselves. What are you doing? If you're in a car every day driving to work and you're the only one there in that car, you are the congestion. You are the reason we have air quality issues. It's those decisions we individually make that collectively create the issues that we're experiencing. And I think government has a good role in stepping forward and saying, we will work with you and we will encourage you. But in the end, the decision's made by each of us.
Angie, how do you get people to change their habits?
That is a tough one. So there's a combination of ways to help people change their habits. Certainly it's the environment in which they live in, and choices are made by the choices they have. So do people have the choice and the option to not be in a car by themselves that they would like to? So certainly there's infrastructure and environmental things that allow people to display the behaviors that they want to. And then certainly education and other motivational factors, whether it's incentives or other things. So it's multifaceted to get people to truly change their behavior. But certainly, like I said, people's choices are made by the choices they have. So I think it starts with some infrastructure and policy and all this that's coming along. And then how do we educate and encourage from there?
Right. Yeah, Karen.
I thought one of the ideas that came out of all of this, and a lot of cities are doing it, and I believe our Downtown Mobility Collaborative is looking at this, and it's called Mobility as a Service, MaaS. And essentially it's a one portal that you go in so that you can connect with all of the available transportation options so that you're not having to look at individual websites to find out, bus routes or, any of the above. Obviously, this is much more robust where there are lots of options for transit and also connecting with other people, whether it's a commuter ride or other options like that. So, I definitely think that's something that's kind of an option or an idea that can be expanded so it makes it more accessible for people to understand where these options are. Making transit easy to use, I think, is definitely a low-hanging fruit, and that's education.
Right. I've got a couple questions here that are a little more specific, but how would you like to see Boise made more accessible and easier for folks to get around? I mean, we're talking about people in wheelchairs, visually impaired folks. Is that how does that factor into planning? How important is that for employers? Where are we on that as a valley? Anybody want to?
Well, I think ACHD is very focused on that. With every project that we do, even if it's just a pavement maintenance project, if we look at the adjacent facilities, and if the pedestrian ramps are not up to code, we do replace them and bring them up to code. So we do that with every project. We recently advertised and are hiring an ADA accessibility coordinator, so we are putting way more focus on that by putting our money where our mouth is, I guess. But we get a lot of feedback from the public on this, especially during construction projects. I think that's a big issue, maintaining accessibility while everything's in construction and torn up. So we're putting a big emphasis on that, and this ADA accessibility coordinator will help that. But I would say it's one of our top things. I mean, the bottom line is it's federal law. It's mandated. But it's also important to us because we understand, we want everyone to be able to get around the city.
I think it's hard. I really think it's hard to do. The city just recently did a project in our downtown with ACHD to replace some just sidewalks that had buckled and trees had caused issues. And we were reached out by somebody who said, I can no longer go into your downtown. It's not accessible to me. And the city did our best to jump on that as quickly as we could because we don't want to exclude anybody from our community. But I think we need to also purposely include as we're planning, going out of our way to make sure that those marginal, whether it be a handicap issue, an ADA issue, or people who maybe are, I don't want to say it, but migrants, but maybe it's other populations that are not normally engaged in the planning process, to make sure that they're part of it, to make sure that we're getting the complete scope of what our planning needs to do and what the needs are out in our community. And I think that's the first step as planners, is to recognize that the people who are able-bodied and maybe showing up to meetings very easily aren't always the voice that we need to be hearing.
I assume, and Angie, maybe you can talk about this from St. Luke's perspective. I mean, we're all talking about that kind of idea of universal design, right? Curb cuts are a great example of that. I just heard a faculty member of Boise State talk about this last night. But, you put in a curb cut so a person in a wheelchair can easily get into the road and across the road and back up. But every one of us then doesn't trip on the curb as we're walking back and forth, and it becomes or if you're on a bicycle or if you're pushing a stroller, it becomes something that it's extremely useful to all of us. That kind of idea of universal design, I mean, must come up in the hospitals all the time, but it can affect all of our design work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, certainly with our hospitals, we have patients and individuals coming in and out that are in various situations where we need to make sure that our campuses and our footprints are compliant for them and easy for them to access. We also do a really good job of tracking if we have patient and or employee injuries or near misses or slips, trips, and falls so that we can heat map if there are places in our campus that seem to be more dangerous or seem to be causing some troubles, and we can hopefully correct those. Our maintenance crew does a really great job in inclement weather, making sure that we identify with signage where the safe routes are, that those are cleared appropriately and all of that. So we really try to be proactive in identifying where there might be some tough spots on our campus and hopefully designing appropriately ahead of time as well.
Well, this is a tough one for radio. This is a really great question, though, and it's going to take the pressure off these folks for a couple minutes. And it goes to what I think Nicole just said. So this is, somebody asks, okay, people here in the room, who got here in alternative transportation? Who rode their bike? I got 1, 2, 3, 5, 6 people. Who took an Uber today? Anybody? Nobody? Did somebody scoot? Who e-scooted over here? Nobody? Students, how did you get to school? Who drove? Let's just do that. And who drove here? Oh, a few people. Who walked? Who walked downtown? That is a great, walked here or walked to your job and then to here? let's do that. Who didn't get in a car at all today? There's still about a dozen people. All right. So we're doing okay. That was a great question, though. Okay. So I got a couple kind of, we've just got a few minutes left. So sort of looking ahead, one of the things I'd ask you folks to think about a little bit was, is there anything that you're sort of, do you have any major fears? I mean, we've talked a lot. What should we be, and not in a, I think in a constructive way, right? Did you go through these four meetings and thought, boy, if we don't address this, we just need to really address this. Is there one of those things for you, Karen?
I had a couple. My first one was cybersecurity. You know, if you get into this world of shared vehicles, autonomous vehicles, what if Wi-Fi goes down? What if it's hacked? I mean, I think there's a lot of conversation around what goes on with these vehicles that are going to be more and more reliant on technology. My second one is really about our quality of life here. If we have a lack of leadership in funding transit, we're going to just keep falling further and further behind in preserving our quality of life. We've got a rapidly growing urban area, and we've talked about air quality. We've talked about all of us collectively as being part of the issue. But if we don't have the leadership to find that transit funding, we're going to just be the status quo.
Angie?
I think for me, one of the things that causes some worries maybe is just the growing and changing demographics of our valley. Certainly, we're a rapidly growing area, and who is it that is moving into our area? What does that look like? And with an aging population or retirees coming in. And so just looking at the changes in our demographic and what are going to be the needs of that community 10, 15, 20 years down the road. So that's one of the things I think in transportation as a healthcare agency, we're certainly keeping our eye on just because it's happening so fast and we're growing so quickly.
So one thing that's already been said is funding, and not just for transit. We definitely need a dedicated funding source for transit, but it's for transportation in general. You know, our needs outweigh our funding, and it's not going to get any better. And so we have to do more with less, and there has to be a conversation about it, you know, increased revenue as well. I think Nicole mentioned this too, and I had written it down, is can we truly collaborate? I mean, you know, having ACHD and Ada County as a single-purpose government for transportation, you know, we have to collaborate and coordinate with all the other agencies in the county, and that has been a challenge. So we have to figure that out going forward. And one other thing I would say, and this came out in one of the talks, is, you know, all this new technology that pops up, I think sometimes the government agencies sit back and think, oh, it's going to be a flash in the pan, it's going to go away, we don't need to deal with it. And so then, and when it's not, those companies, those private companies coming in, then kind of set the policies and the laws around those. And I think we need to be proactive and as the agencies, and we need to set the policies and the goals and put those parameters around how we want to see our communities and the lifestyle we want to live, and not let those companies come in and set those priorities and goals for us.
All of the above.
I really think a biggest fear I have, and it goes back to, what is this valley going to be in 40 to 60 years? Is it going to be livable? I have a daughter who's a senior, sorry guys, at Timberland High School. And when I talk to her about college, she doesn't want to stay in Idaho. She doesn't want to be here. She doesn't see this as the place that she wants to be long term. And that makes me sad. This is a great community, a great valley, but if we don't start looking at what the next generations want, we are going to be nowhere, because the people moving in here are retiring. It's great. I'm glad they love Boise. But what happens in 20 years? Those retirees are gone. Who's left? And I want our community to be a great place for all generations, not one generation, not just for what we're preserving, but what we're building for the next.
That's a great way to kind of call this to a close, and we've hit our time. If you want to help me here in a sec, thank Diane Bevins and Karin Sonder and Angie Gribble and Nicole Baird Spencer for taking... And again, not just the time that they were, not the hour they spent up here, but a summer of commitment. So thank you very much. We really appreciate it. Also a thanks to our co-sponsors here, the Southwest Idaho of WTS, Urban Land Institute of Idaho, Ada County Highway District, Commuter Ride, and the Community Planning Association of Southwest Idaho. And thank you all for coming. And once again, we've been the City Club of Boise. Thank you.
You've been listening to the City Club of Boise, a public forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. The next City Club forum taking place on Wednesday, the 20th of November, and that's at the Grove Hotel in downtown Boise, focusing on a shortage of skilled laborers coming for industry and the trades, workforce development, the next City Club of Boise forum, and you can register for that at cityclubofboise.org. Connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.